This is All Things Considered on KNKX. I'm Ed Ronco. As a country, the United States has had previous moments where race has come into the forefront of our national dialogue and where protests have called for change. Politico magazine recently published takes from a handful of experts about whether this current moment of racial reckoning is any different than those previous. They included a short essay from Christopher Sebastian Parker, a professor of political science at the University of Washington. He joins us now to talk about that. Professor Parker, welcome.
Thank you for having me, Ed.
You've written extensively about race in this country. Your first book was about black veterans in the South. Another of your books focuses on the attitudes and beliefs of the Tea Party. This recent essay in Politico talks about whether anything's different in this moment. And you say that for you, the jury is still out. What did you mean?
Well, what I mean by that is, I mean, we have these upheavals, it seems like. Usually it's around every 50 years. And, you know, the last time, of course, was in the 1960s. And, you know, when it looked like, you know, monumental change was going to happen. And so in spite of, you know, Johnson's attempt with the Great Society program, the fact of the matter is things weren't really a whole lot better. And I think a lot of that had to do with the fact that, and the literature bears this out, and that there are a lot of whites who were like, okay, well, you got the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. So why, you know, aren't black people, you know, happy with that? Well, the fact of the matter is those were really addressed to the South, right? The former Confederate states of the South. Beyond the South, black folks were permitted to vote and discrimination was not statutory, right? So but we still had these same problems, right? Not necessarily when it comes to the vote, but because of labor market discrimination, housing discrimination, educational discrimination. Those things were still happening beyond the South. And so the freedom struggle then moved to a different phase. So what happens is you had this backlash that was a reaction to, you know, the urban crisis in the late 1960s. Other people call them riots. You know, I tend to call them rebellions, right? And the Republican Party from that point forward started moving to the right at a relatively rapid clip. And so then, so whatever change we had or was promised by the Great Society program was essentially staunched. And so it's akin to black people playing Charlie Brown to white people's Lucy, right? Here's a football, come kick it, here's right here, boom, and it gets snatched away. And so I think this moment has the potential, you know, to be a replay of the Peanuts. We had another chance during Reconstruction. Right. Everything was lined up right. Right. You had the radical Republicans, you know, who were, you know, led by Abraham Lincoln. Lincoln gets assassinated. And so then Andrew Johnson takes over. Andrew Johnson defunds. Nobody ever talks about this. Defunds the Freedmen's Bureau. Right. Now, the Freedmen's Bureau was set up to help formerly enslaved black folks make a transition to freedmen. Right. Johnson takes over and he defunds it. And things start going downhill at that point. You had this period, what was called redemption in the South, where you had these Southern governments, quote unquote, redeem Southern society and start to slow down and reverse Reconstruction. And then you had the famous or infamous Hayes-Tilden Compromise, where one of the big things was, is that in order for Rutherford B. Hayes to become president, he was a Republican, because you had the same thing happen then that we just recently had in 2016, where you had one party won the popular vote, the other party won the electoral college. And in order to move on, you know, with an exchange of power, the Hayes-Tilden Compromise was engineered. And a big piece of that compromise was that the Union Army, which had been stationed in the South to ensure compliance with the 14th Amendment. Well, in order to let Rutherford B. Hayes take the White House, they struck a deal where the Republicans would agree to remove the federal troops, and that hastened redemption. So there was a period of time where, you know, American democracy, the promise of it was being fulfilled, right, until Lincoln was assassinated, Johnson took over, and then you had the deconstruction of Reconstruction with redemption, and then you had the federal troops removed, right? And then that hastened in this era of what we now call Jim Crow.
So much of what history has called compromise throughout the years has come at the expense of the people who most needed the change.
Exactly. Northern and Southern rapprochement you know, was bought or purchased at the expense of Black folks. I'm not so sure we can say that about the late 1960s, early 1970s, right? I don't think there was really a rapprochement to be had. But politicians, but that's basically what happened. You know, the rights of Black people were basically sacrificed, I guess you're right, on the altar of, you know, political conciliation.
You've studied this, obviously, for years and years and years. You work in political science. Does having that long view of the incremental steps this country has taken through the generations give you hope, give you skepticism, a mix of both? I mean, what does that do for you in the way you view our chances at any kind of forward motion here?
So here's the thing. I'll preface what I'm going to say by saying I'm a Black man in America, right? It's kind of hard to be an optimist, especially if one is educated, because one then knows the history. And not only do I know the history, you know, I study empirically, you know, with the tools of social science in the contemporary context. And it's really hard to be optimistic. I mean, the face of racism, it changes through time, right? There was once back in the day, like prior to the 1960s, this thing called Jim Crow racism, old fashioned racism. And that was a racism in which whites believed that Black people were just biologically inferior. Now, that could be used as a means of, you know, justifying the subordinate position of Black folks, which can be tied to capitalism, right? You know, along comes the 1960s and the civil rights movement. And white folks kind of figured out it was no longer fashionable, at least to report it. They might have still believed it, right? But to report it. So then racism shifted more towards this idea that it's not that Black people are necessarily culturally inferior. It's that they violate cherished American values, you know, one of which is the Protestant work ethic. So then Black people were seen as lazy. And then that was married to this what's called anti-Black affect, or this dislike of Black people. And in some ways, it's because of government intervention on their part that Black people were disliked, right? Because there are some white folks that were like, they shouldn't need that, right? These other populations, these Italians, Jews, Asian Americans, you know, were able to make it without much in the way of government interference. So why should Black people need that? So let me, in the present context, let me give you an example. So there was a survey that was recently conducted by a colleague at the University of Maryland. She surveyed protesters in New York City, 61% of whom were white. And that's a good thing. But the problem is that these are exigent circumstances, right? You know, people are confined for the most part, or they should be, to their homes, right? And so they're forced to watch these images of George Floyd getting murdered over and over again. And, you know, reports of Breonna Taylor, you know, and then of Ahmaud Arbery getting killed by these white vigilantes, one of whom was a retired cop. And so people are confined, and it's like, well, wait a second. There are these protests going on. Let's go out and protest, right? And so to some people, now this is a cynic in me saying this, Ed, you have Biff and Bethany that are locked up in their house. And it's like, it's a protest. Let's go do this, right? And so we can get out of the house, right? Now, I'm not saying none of it's sincere, because I'm quite sure I'd be remiss if I didn't say that, because I'm quite sure there is some sincerity, right? But it wouldn't surprise me if you had your shares of Biffs and Bethany's out there just hanging out protesting because they're bored and they're confined to the house. So what then happens when things return to some sense of normalcy and Biff and Bethany go back to college?
Yeah, I mean, it's clear, right, that some people want this sweeping change to happen fast, defunding police departments right away, for example. That's different energy than the long-term work of dismantling segregated neighborhoods or building Black wealth or any of the kind of longer-term things. And I wonder if you have concern, like you just said, over interest of allies flagging, getting back to the idea of, is this time different?
Yes, yes, yes. I'm very skeptical about that, because like some people will say, you know, and I agree, okay, we have a racist president. COVID is really laying bare along with what's happening, you know, what happened in the wake of George Floyd, right? Police brutality and health disparities based on race, right? We've always had racist presidents, right? So let's forget about that one, right? Most people in the know have known for a very long time, you know, that there are race-related health disparities, right? That's nothing new. This isn't the first time, you know, police brutality, you know, has kicked off or sparked urban unrest. So then what is new about this? Well, what's new about it is the confluence of all of these things happening at the same time. And the whole idea that COVID is confining people to their homes. So we don't have the release of athletic events or parties or going to bars and stuff like that that permit us to avoid these images. Now, for Black folks, this is constant for us, right? But for white folks, they're like, oh my God, right? Now, even though we've had racist presidents in the past, right, they have mainly done it, well, maybe with the exception of Woodrow Wilson, they have mainly done it, you know, through the use of dog whistles, right? Like saying, we need more law and order. Well, that's code for it. We need to keep these Black people in their places. But with Trump, he has ripped the covers off, right? But you got some progressive whites that are like, oh my God, really? And I think a number of them are outraged by this because this is not the America that they thought they knew.
You're working on a book to be titled The Great White Hope, Donald Trump, Race, and the Crisis of American Democracy. Working in news, we struggle to keep up with everything, and we get to write something new every day. And so I've just been wondering, when you're writing a book about what's going on right now, what's that process like? I mean, do you find yourself revising and revising and revising because things are changing too quickly? I'm just curious.
So the underlying story remains the same. Trump supporters are not driven by, as many people thought initially, economic anxiety. They're driven by this anxiety associated with the belief that they're losing, quote unquote, their country. And when I say there, I'm referring to people who white, middle class or better off, Christian, native born, straight, male. If one cannot check all of those boxes, one is not considered to be a quote unquote real American. And so those people that can't check all those boxes, they fear are taking their country from them. And that's what they're reacting against. Now, that's the principal reason why Trump gets away with everything he gets away with. These people see Trump as the last line of defense standing between them and the rest of us. That is to say, progressive, people of color, feminists, immigrants. He's the last line of defense. So that whole story, even though some of the substantive stuff changes, like, okay, we have COVID, you know, now we got the protests, right? That stuff changes, right? But the underlying story remains the same.
You wrote in the Seattle Times that people confuse nationalism for patriotism, and that patriotism can and often does and should take the form of people disagreeing with their country and sacrificing something to change it.
So when people criticize the United States, you get these right wingers that say, America, love it or leave it. That's not patriotism, right? Especially if the country is not realizing the values on which it was founded, right? The big problem with the United States isn't about the values. It's about the lack of universal applications of the values. And so, in other words, if we're talking about equality, right? And we're talking about tolerance. That should be applied to everybody. And so what you have here, you have this principal policy gap, or you have this gap that separates social practice from beliefs, right? And values. And if these things can come into alignment, right, then I think a lot of our problems would be solved. And so it is incumbent on the patriot to hold the country accountable to realize the promise of democracy, and in this case, American democracy, which consists of freedom, equality, and toleration. As long as we're not practicing those, the patriot is obligated to criticize the country. And for those people who always talking about, well, you know, you're not patriotic if you're criticizing the country and you're trying to hold the president's feet to the fire. Well, guess what? These people are clearly ignorant of history, or they just don't want to know history, because this country was founded on dissent. Period. Full stop.
I have a thousand more questions for you, but they'll have to wait to another time.
Okay.
I've thoroughly enjoyed being able to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ed.